Random House Audio presents Crazy Rich Asians by Kevin Kwan. Read for you by Lin Chen. Prologue. The Cousins. London, 1986. Nicholas Young slumped into the nearest seat in the hotel lobby, drained from the 16-hour flight from Singapore, the train ride from Heathrow Airport, and trudging through the rain-soaked streets. His cousin Astrid Leung shivered stoically next to him, all because her mother Felicity, his Dai Gu Che, or Big Aunt in Cantonese, said it was a sin to take a taxi 9 blocks and forced everyone to walk all the way from Piccadilly Tube Station. Anyone else happening upon the scene might have noticed an unusually composed 8-year-old boy and an ethereal wisp of a girl sitting quietly in a corner. But all Reginald Ormsby saw from his desk overlooking the lobby were 2 little Chinese children staining the damask settee with their sodden coats. And it only got worse from there. 3 Chinese women stood nearby, frantically blotting themselves dry with tissues, while a teenager slid wildly across the lobby, his sneakers leaving muddy tracks on the black and white checkerboard marble. Ormsby rushed downstairs from the mezzanine, knowing he could more efficiently dispatch these foreigners than his front desk clerks.
"Good evening. I am the general manager. Can I help you?"
he said slowly, over-enunciating every word.
"Yes, good evening. We have a reservation,"
the woman replied in perfect English. Ormsby peered at her in surprise.
"What name is it under?"
"Eleanor Young and family."
Ormsby froze. He recognized the name, especially since the Young party had booked the Lancaster suite. But who could have imagined that Eleanor Young would turn out to be Chinese? And how on earth did she end up here? The Dorchester or the Ritz might let this kind in, but this was the Cawthorpe, owned by the Cawthorpe Cavendish Gores since the reign of George IV, and run for all intents and purposes like a private club for the sort of families that appeared in Debrett's or the Almanac de Gotha. Ormsby considered the bedraggled women and the dripping children. The Dowager Marchioness of Uckfield was staying through the weekend, and he could scarcely imagine what she would make of these folk appearing at breakfast tomorrow. He made a swift decision.
"I'm terribly sorry, but I can't seem to find a booking under that name."
"Are you sure?" Eleanor asked in surprise.
"Quite sure."
Ormsby grinned tightly. Felicity Leung joined her sister-in-law at the front desk. "Is there a problem?" she asked impatiently, eager to get to the room to dry her hair.
"Alamak!"
Eleanor sighed, using the popular Malay exclamation for, "Oh my God."
"They can't find our reservation."
"How come? Maybe you booked it under another name?" Felicity inquired.
"No la, why would I do that? It was always booked under my name," Eleanor replied irritatedly.
Why did Felicity always assume she was incompetent? She turned back to the manager.
"Sir, can you please check again? I reconfirm our reservation just 2 days ago. We're supposed to be in your largest suite."
"Yes, I know you booked the Lancaster suite, but I can't find your name anywhere,"
Ormsby insisted.
"Excuse me, but if you know we booked the Lancaster suite, why don't we have the room?" Felicity asked, confused.
"Bloody hell."
Ormsby cursed at his own slip-up.
"No, no, you misunderstood. What I meant was that you might think you booked the Lancaster suite, but I certainly can't find any record of it."
He turned away for a moment, pretending to rummage through some other paperwork. Felicity leaned over the polished oak counter and pulled the leather-bound reservations book toward her, flipping through pages.
"Look, it says right here, Mrs. Eleanor Young, Lancaster Suite for 4 nights. Do you not see this?"
"Madame, that is private!"
Ormsby snapped in fury, startling his 2 junior clerks who glanced uncomfortably at their manager. Felicity peered at the balding, red-faced man, the situation suddenly becoming abundantly clear. She hadn't seen this particular brand of superior sneer since she was a child growing up in the waning days of colonial Singapore, and she thought this kind of overt racism had ceased to exist.
"Sir,"
she said politely but firmly.
This hotel came highly recommended to us by Mrs. Mintz, the wife of the Anglican Bishop of Singapore, and I clearly saw our name in your registry book. I don't know what sort of funny business is going on, but we have traveled a very long way, and our children are tired and cold. I insist that you honor our reservation.
Ormsby was indignant. How dare this Chinese woman, with a Thatcheresque perm and preposterous English accent, speak to him in such a manner?
I'm afraid we simply do not have anything available, he declared.
Are you telling me that there are no rooms left in this entire hotel?
Eleanor said incredulously.
Yes, he replied curtly.
Where are we supposed to go at this hour? Eleanor asked.
Perhaps someplace in Chinatown?
Ormsby sniffed. These foreigners had wasted enough of his time. Felicity went back to where her younger sister Alexandra Chang stood guarding the luggage.
Finally, I can't wait to take a hot bath, Alexandra said eagerly.
Actually, this odious man is refusing to give us our room, Felicity said, making no attempt to hide her fury.
What? Why? Alexandra asked, completely confused.
I think it has something to do with us being Chinese, Felicity said, as if she didn't quite believe her own words.
Gumsuya! How rotten!
Alexandra exclaimed.
Let me talk to him. Living in Hong Kong, I have more experience dealing with these types.
Alex, don't bother. He's a typical Ang Mo Gao Sai,
Eleanor exclaimed. Even though Felicity had to agree that this fellow was being particularly horrid, she still flinched at Eleanor's use of this colorful insult. In Hokkien Chinese, Ang Mo Gao Sai translates to red-haired dog shit and is most often shortened to a simple Ang Mo when referring to Caucasians.
Isn't this supposed to be one of London's top hotels? How can they get away with that sort of behavior? Alexandra asked.
Exactly, Felicity raged on.
The English are normally so lovely. I have never been treated like this in all my years coming here.
Eleanor nodded in agreement, even though privately she felt that Felicity was partly to blame for this fiasco. If Felicity wasn't so giam siap and had let them take a taxi from Heathrow instead of always pinching pennies, they would have arrived looking far less disheveled. Of course, it didn't help that her sisters-in-law always looked so dowdy. She had to dress down whenever she traveled with them, ever since that trip to Thailand when everyone mistook them for her maids. Edison Cheng, Alexandra's 12-year-old son, approached the ladies nonchalantly, sipping soda from a tall glass.
Aya, Eddie, where did you get that? Alexandra exclaimed.
From the bartender, of course.
How did you pay for it?
I didn't. I told him to charge it to our suite,
Eddie replied breezily.
Can we go up now? I'm starving, and I want to order from room service.
Felicity shook her head in disapproval. Hong Kong boys were notoriously pampered, but this nephew of hers was incorrigible. Good thing they were here to put him in boarding school, where he would have some sense knocked into him. Cold morning showers and stale toast with Bovril was what he needed.
No, no. We're not staying here anymore.
Go and watch Nikki and Astrid while we decide what to do, Felicity instructed. Eddie walked over to his younger cousins, resuming the game they had begun on the plane.
Off the sofa. Remember, I'm the chairman, so I'm the one who gets to sit, he commanded. Here, Nikki, hold my glass while I sip from the straw. Astrid, you're my executive secretary, so you need to massage my shoulders.
I don't know why you get to be the chairman while Nikki is the vice president and I have to be the secretary, Astrid protested.
Didn't I explain this already? I'm the chairman because I am 4 years older than the both of you. You're the executive secretary because you're the girl. I need a girl to massage my shoulders and to help choose jewelry for all my mistresses. My best friend Leo's father, Ming Ka Ching, is the third richest man in Hong Kong, and that's what his executive secretary does.
Eddie, if you want me to be your vice president, I should be doing something more important than holding your glass, Nick argued. We still haven't decided what our company makes.
I've decided we make custom limousines like Rolls Royces and Jags, Eddie declared.
Can't we make something cooler like a time machine? Nick asked.
Well, These are ultra-special limousines with features like jacuzzis, secret compartments, and James Bond ejector seats, Eddie said, bouncing up from the settee so suddenly that he knocked the glass out of Nick's hand. Coca-Cola spilled everywhere, and the sound of smashing glass pierced the lobby. The bell captain, concierge, and front desk clerks glared at the children. Alexandra rushed over, shaking a finger in dismay.
Eddie, look what you've done.
It wasn't my fault. Nikki was the one who dropped it, Eddie began.
But it's your glass, and you hid it out of my hand, Nick defended himself.
Ormsby approached Felicity and Eleanor.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave the premises.
Can we just use your telephone? Eleanor pleaded.
I do think the children have done quite enough damage for one night. Don't you? He hissed.
It was still drizzling, and the group huddled under a green and white striped awning on Brook Street, while Felicity stood inside a phone booth frantically calling other hotels.
Guy Gouchier looks like a soldier in a sentry box in that red booth, Nick observed, rather thrilled by the strange turn of events.
Mummy, what are we going to do if we can't find a place to stay tonight? Maybe we can sleep in Hyde Park. There's an amazing weeping beech in Hyde Park called the Upside Down Tree, and its branches hang down so low that it's almost like a cave. We can all sleep underneath and be protected.
Don't talk nonsense. No one is sleeping in the park. Guy Gouchier is calling other hotels right now, Eleanor said, thinking that her son was getting far too precocious for his own good.
Oh, I want to sleep in the park, Astrid squealed in delight. Nikki, remember how we moved that big iron bed at Amma's house into the garden and slept under the stars one night?
Well, you two can sleep in the long cow for all I care, but I'll take the big royal suite where I can order club sandwiches with champagne and caviar, Eddie said.
Don't be ridiculous, Eddie. No one's sleeping in the gutter.
And when have you ever had caviar? His mother asked.
At Leo's house. Their butler always serves us caviar with little triangles of toasted bread, and it's always Iranian beluga, because Leo's mom says Iranian caviar is the best, Eddie declared.
Connie Ming would say something like that, Alexandra muttered under her breath, glad her son was finally away from that family's influence. Inside the telephone booth, Felicity was trying to explain the predicament to her husband over a crackly connection to Singapore.
What nonsense, Law. You should have demanded the room, Harry Leung fumed.
You are always too polite. These service people need to be put in their place. Did you tell them who we are? I'm going to call up the Minister of Trade and Investment right now.
Come on, Harry, you're not helping. I've called more than 10 hotels already. Who knew that today was Commonwealth Day?
Every VIP is in town and everyone is booked solid.
Poor Astrid is soaked through. We need to find some place for tonight before your daughter catches her death of cold.
Did you try calling your cousin Leonard? Maybe you could take a train straight to Surrey, Harry suggested.
I did. He's not in. He's grouse hunting in Scotland all weekend.
What a bloody mess, Harry sighed. Let me call Tommy Toe over at the Singapore Embassy. I'm sure they can sort things out. What is the name of this bloody racist hotel?
The Carthorpe, Felicity answered.
Allah, Mark, is this the place owned by Rupert Carthorpe something something?
Harry asked, suddenly perking up.
I have no idea.
Where is it located?
It's in Mayfair, close to Bond Street. It's actually a rather beautiful hotel if it wasn't for this horrible manager.
Yes, I think that's it. I played golf with Rupert What's-His-Name and a few other Brits last month in California, and I remember him telling me all about his place.
Felicity, I have an idea. I'm going to call this Rupert fellow. Just stay put, and I'll call you back.
Ormsby stared in disbelief when the three Chinese children burst through the front door again, barely an hour after he had evicted the whole lot of them.
Eddie, I'm getting myself a drink. If you want one, go get it yourself.
Nick said firmly to his cousin as he walked toward the lounge.
Remember what your mummy said. It's too late for us to drink cokes,
Astrid warned as she skipped through the lobby, trying to catch up with the boys.
Well, then, I'll get a rum and coke, Eddie said brazenly.
What on God's green earth?
Ormsby bellowed, storming across the lobby to intercept the children. Before he could reach them, he suddenly caught sight of Lord Rupert Cawthorpe Cavendish Gore ushering the Chinese woman into the lobby, seemingly in the midst of conducting a tour.
"And my grandfather brought over René Lalique in 1918 to do the glass murals you see here in the Great Hall. Needless to say, Lutyens, who supervised the restoration, did not approve of these Art Nouveau flourishes."
The woman laughed politely. The staff quickly snapped to attention, surprised to see the old lord, who hadn't set foot inside the hotel in years. Lord Rupert turned toward the hotel manager.
"Ah, Wormsby, isn't it?"
"Yes, my lord," he said, too dazed to correct his boss. "Would you kindly have some rooms readied for the lovely Mrs. Young, Mrs. Leung, and Mrs. Cheng?"
"But, sir, I just..." Ormsby tried to protest.
"And Wormsby," Lord Rupert continued dismissively, "I am entrusting you to inform the staff of a very important announcement. As of this evening, my family's long history as custodians of the Cawthorpe has come to an end."
Ormsby stared at him in utter disbelief.
"My lord, surely there's some mistake?"
"No, no mistake at all. I sold the Cawthorpe a short while ago, lock, stock, and barrel. May I present the new mistress, Mrs. Felicity Leung?"
"What?"
"Yes, Mrs. Leung's husband, Harry Leung, a wonderful chap with a lethal right-arm swing, whom I met at Pebble Beach, called me up and made me a marvelous offer. I can now devote all my time to bone-fishing in Eleuthera without having to worry about this gothic pile."
Ormsby stared at the women, his mouth agape.
"Ladies, why don't we join your adorable children at the long bar for a toast?" Lord Rupert said merrily.
"That would be wonderful," Eleanor replied. "But first, Felicity, isn't there something you wanted to tell this man?"
Felicity turned to Ormsby, now looking as if he was about to faint.
"Oh, yes, I almost forgot," she began with a smile.
"I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave the premises."
Part 1. Nowhere in the world are there to be found people richer than the Chinese. Ibn Battuta, 14th century. Chapter 1. Nicholas Young and Rachel Chu. New York, 2010. "You sure about this?" Rachel asked again, blowing softly on the surface of her steaming cup of tea. They were sitting at their usual window table at Tea and Sympathy, and Nick had just invited her to spend the summer with him in Asia.
"Rachel, I'd love it if you came," Nick reassured her. "You weren't planning on teaching this summer, so what's your worry? Think you won't be able to handle the heat and humidity?"
"No, that's not it. I know you're going to be so busy with all your best man duties, and I wouldn't want to distract you," Rachel said.
"What distraction? Colin's wedding is only going to take up the first week in Singapore, and then we can spend the rest of the summer just bumming around Asia. Come on, let me show you where I grew up. I want to take you to all my favorite haunts."
"Will you show me the sacred cave where you lost your virginity?" Rachel teased, arching an eyebrow playfully.
"Definitely. We can even stage a reenactment."
Nick laughed, slathering jam and clotted cream onto a scone still warm from the oven.
"And doesn't a good friend of yours live in Singapore?"
"Yes, Paik Lin, my best friend from college," Rachel said. "She's been trying to get me to come visit for years."
"All the more reason. Rachel, you're going to love it. And I just know you're going to flip out over the food. You do realize Singapore is the most food-obsessed country on the planet."
"Well, just watching the way you fawn over everything you eat, I figured it's pretty much the national sport."
"Remember Calvin Trillin's New Yorker piece on Singapore street foods? I'll take you to all the local dives even he doesn't know about."
Nick took another bite of his fluffy scone and continued with his mouth full.
"I know how much you love these scones. Just wait till you taste my ama's."
"Your ama bakes scones?" Rachel tried to imagine a traditional Chinese grandmother preparing this quintessentially English confection.
"Well, she doesn't exactly bake them herself, but she has the best scones in the world, you'll see."
Nick said, turning around reflexively to make sure no one in the cozy little spot had overheard him. He didn't want to become persona non grata at his favorite cafe for carelessly pledging allegiance to another scone, even if it was his grandmother's. At a neighboring table, the girl huddled behind a three-tiered stand piled high with finger sandwiches was getting increasingly excited by the conversation she was overhearing. She suspected it might be him, but now she had absolute confirmation. It was Nicholas Young. Even though she was only 15 at the time, Celine Lim never forgot the day she first laid eyes on him. It was at Palau Club, Singapore's most prestigious private country club, where membership was practically harder to obtain than a knighthood. They were having lunch at the poolside cafe when Nicholas strolled past their table and flashed that devastating grin of his at her sister Charlotte. "Is that one of the Leung brothers?" their mother had asked. "No, that's Nicholas Young, a cousin of the Leungs," Charlotte replied. "Philip Young's boy? Yeah, when did he shoot up like that? He's so handsome now," Mrs. Lim exclaimed. "He's just back from Oxford, double majored in history and law," Charlotte added, anticipating her mother's next question. "Why didn't you get up and talk to him?" Mrs. Lim said excitedly. "Why should I bother when you swat away every guy who dares come near?" Charlotte answered curtly. "A la Mac, stupid girl, I am only trying to protect you from fortune hunters. This one you'd be lucky to have. This one you can chong." Celine couldn't believe her mother was actually encouraging her big sister to snatch this boy. She stared curiously at Nicholas, now laughing animatedly with his friends at a table under a blue and white umbrella by the pool. Even from afar, he stood out in high relief. Unlike the other fellows with their regulation Indian barbershop haircuts, Nicholas had perfectly tousled black hair, chiseled Cantonese pop idol features, and impossibly thick eyelashes. He was the cutest, dreamiest guy she'd ever seen.
"Charlotte, why don't you go over and invite him to your fundraiser on Saturday?" their mother kept on.
"Stop it, Mum," Charlotte smiled through gritted teeth. "I know what I'm doing." As it turned out, Charlotte did not know what she was doing, since Nicholas never showed up at her fundraiser, much to their mother's eternal disappointment. But that afternoon at Palau Club left such an indelible mark on Celine's adolescent memory that 6 years later, and on the other side of the planet, she still recognized him.
"Hannah, let me get a picture of you with that delicious sticky toffee pudding," Celine said, taking out her camera phone.
She pointed it in the direction of her friend, but surreptitiously trained the lens on Nicholas. She snapped the photo and immediately emailed it to her sister, who now lived in Atherton, California. Her phone pinged minutes later. Big sis.
"OMFG, that's Nick Young. Where are you?"
Celine Lim.
T&S.
Big sis.
"Who's the girl he's with?"
Celine Lim.
GF, I think. Looks ABC, you know. American-born Chinese.
Big sis. Do you see a ring?
Celine Lim. No ring.
Big sis.
PLS, spy for me.
Celine Lim.
You owe me big time.
Nick gazed out the cafe window, marveling at the people with tiny dogs parading along this stretch of Greenwich Avenue, as if it were a catwalk for the city's most fashionable breeds. A year ago, French bulldogs were all the rage, but now it looked like Italian greyhounds were giving the Frenchies a run for their money. He faced Rachel again, resuming his campaign.
"The great thing about starting out in Singapore is that it's the perfect base. Malaysia is just across a bridge, and it's a quick hop to Hong Kong, Cambodia, Thailand. We can even go island hopping off Indonesia. It all sounds amazing, but 10 weeks, I don't know if I want to be away that long,"
Rachel mused. She could sense Nick's eagerness, and the idea of visiting Asia again filled her with excitement. She had spent a year teaching in Chengdu between college and grad school, but couldn't afford to travel anywhere beyond China's borders back then. As an economist, she certainly knew enough about Singapore, this tiny, intriguing island at the tip of the Malay Peninsula, which had transformed within a few short decades from a British colonial backwater into the country with the world's highest concentration of millionaires. It would be fascinating to see the place up close, especially with Nick as her guide. Yet, something about this trip made Rachel a little apprehensive, and she couldn't help but ponder the deeper implications. Nick made it seem so spontaneous, but knowing him, she was sure he had put far more thought into it than he let on. They had been together for almost 2 years, and now he was inviting her on an extended trip to visit his hometown, to attend his best friend's wedding, no less. Did this mean what she thought it did? Rachel peered into her teacup, wishing she could divine something from the stray leaves pooled at the bottom of the deep golden Assam. She had never been the sort of girl who longed for fairy tale endings. Being 29, she was, by Chinese standards, well into old maid territory. And even though her busybody relatives were perpetually trying to set her up, she had spent the better part of her 20s focused on getting through grad school, finishing her dissertation, and jump-starting her career in academia. This surprise invitation, however, sparked some vestigial instinct within her. He wants to take me home. He wants me to meet his family. The long-dormant romantic in her was awakening, and she knew there was only one answer to give. I'll have to check with my dean to see when I'm needed back, but you know what? Let's do this, Rachel declared. Nick leaned across the table, kissing her jubilantly. Minutes later, before Rachel herself knew for certain her summer plans, the details of her conversation had already begun to spread far and wide, circling the globe like a virus set loose. After Celine Lim, Parsons School of Design fashion major, emailed her sister Charlotte Lim, recently engaged to venture capitalist Henry Chu in California, Charlotte called her best friend Daphne Ma, Sir Benedict Ma's youngest daughter, in Singapore, and breathlessly filled her in. Daphne texted 8 friends, including Carmen Quek, granddaughter of Robert Sugar King Quek in Shanghai, whose cousin Amelia Quek had gone to Oxford with Nicholas Young. Amelia simply had to IM her friend Justina Wei, the instant noodle heiress, in Hong Kong, and Justina, whose office at Hutchinson Whampoa was right across the hall from Roderick Liang's, of the Liang Finance Group Liang's, simply had to interrupt his conference call to share this juicy tidbit. Roderick, in turn, Skyped his girlfriend Lauren Lee, who was holidaying at the Royal Mansour in Marrakesh with her grandmother, Mrs. Lee Yongqian, no introductions necessary, and her aunt, Patsy Teo, Miss Taiwan, 1979, now the ex-wife of telecom mogul Dixon Teo. Patsy made a poolside call to Jacqueline Ling, granddaughter of philanthropist Ling Yin Chow in London, knowing full well that Jacqueline would have a direct line to Cassandra Shang, Nicholas Young's second cousin, who spent every spring at her family's vast estate in Surrey. And so, this exotic strain of gossip spread rapidly through the Levantine networks of the Asian jet set, and within a few hours, almost everyone in this exclusive circle knew that Nicholas Young was bringing a girl home to Singapore. And alamak, this was big news. Chapter 2. Eleanor Young, Singapore. Everyone knew that Dato Taito Lui made his first fortune the dirty way by bringing down Lung Hall Bank in the early 80s. But in the 2 decades since, the efforts of his wife, Datin Carol Tai, on behalf of the right charities, had burnished the Tai name into one of respectability. Indeed, the Malaysian honorific titles of Dato and Datin, similar to a British lord and lady, had been conferred on them by the Sultan of Malaysia. Every Thursday, the Datin held a Bible study luncheon for her closest friends in her bedroom,
and Eleanor Young was sure to attend. Carol's palatial bedroom was not actually in the sprawling glass and steel structure everyone living along Kiam Hock Road nicknamed the Star Trek House. Instead, on the advice of her husband's security team, the bedroom was hidden away in the pool pavilion, a white travertine fortress that spanned the swimming pool like a postmodern Taj Mahal. To get there, you either had to follow the footpath that wound along the coral rock gardens or take the shortcut through the service wing. Eleanor always preferred the quicker route, since she assiduously avoided the sun to maintain her porcelain-white complexion. And also, as Carol's oldest friend, she considered herself exempt from the formalities of waiting at the front door, being announced by the butler, and all that nonsense. Besides, Eleanor enjoyed passing through the kitchens. The old amas, squatting over enamel double boilers, would always open the lids for Eleanor to sniff the smoky medicinal herbs being brewed for Carol's husband, natural Viagra, as he called it. And the kitchen maids gutting fish in the courtyard would fawn over how youthful Mrs. Young still looked for 60, what with her fashionably shagged chin-length hair and her unwrinkled face, before furiously debating, the moment she was out of earshot, what expensive new cosmetic procedure Mrs. Young must have endured. By the time Eleanor arrived at Carol's bedroom, the Bible study regulars, Daisy Fu, Lorena Lim, and Nadine Shaw, would be assembled and waiting. Here, sheltered from the harsh equatorial heat, these longtime friends would sprawl languorously about the room, analyzing the Bible verses assigned in their study guides. The centerpiece of Carol's bedroom was her Qing Dynasty bed, made of huanghuali, an exceedingly rare rosewood now virtually extinct. And this place of honor was always reserved for Eleanor, for even though this was Carol's house and she was the one married to the billionaire financier, Carol still deferred to her. This was the way things had been since their childhood as neighbors growing up on Sarangoon Road, mainly because, coming from a Chinese-speaking family, Carol had always felt inferior to Eleanor, who was brought up speaking English first. The others also kowtowed to her, because even among these exceedingly well-married ladies, Eleanor had trumped them all by becoming Mrs. Philip Young. Today's lunch started off with braised quail and abalone over hand-pulled noodles, and Daisy, married to the rubber magnate QT Fu, but born a Wong of the Ipo Wongs, fought to separate the starchy noodles while trying to find 1 Timothy in her King James Bible. With her bobbed perm and her rimless reading glasses perched at the tip of her nose, she looked like the principal of a girls' school. At 64, she was the oldest of the ladies, and even though everyone else was on the New American Standard, Daisy always insisted on reading from her version, saying,
"I went to convent school and was taught by nuns, you know, so it will always be King James for me."
Tiny droplets of garlicky broth splattered onto the tissue-like page, but she managed to keep the good book open with one hand while deftly maneuvering her ivory chopsticks with the other. Nadine, meanwhile, was busily flipping through her Bible, the latest issue of Singapore Tattle. Every month, she couldn't wait to see how many pictures of her daughter Francesca, the celebrated Shaw Foods heiress, were featured in the soiree section of the magazine. Nadine herself was a fixture in the social pages, what with her kabuki-esque makeup, tropical fruit-sized jewels, and over-teased hair.
"Aya, Carol, Tattle devoted 2 full pages to your Christian Helpers fashion gala," Nadine exclaimed.
"Already? I didn't realize it would come out so quickly," Carol remarked.
Unlike Nadine, she was always a bit embarrassed to find herself in magazines, even though editors constantly fawned over her classic Shanghainese songstress looks. Carol simply felt obligated to attend a few charity galas every week, as any good born-again Christian should, and because her husband kept reminding her that
being Mother Teresa is good for business.
Nadine scanned the glossy pages up and down.
"That Lena Tech has really put on weight since her Mediterranean cruise, hasn't she?" It must be those all-you-can-eat buffets. You always feel like you have to eat more to get your money's worth. She better be careful. All those tech women end up with fat ankles. I don't think she cares how fat her ankles get. Do you know how much she inherited when her father died? I heard she and her five brothers got $700 million each, Lorena said from her chaise lounge. Is that all? I thought Lena had at least $1 billion, Nadine sniffed. Hey, so strange, Elle. How come there's no picture of your pretty niece, Astrid? I remember all the photographers swarming around her that day.
Those photographers were wasting their time. Astrid's pictures are never published anywhere. Her mother made a deal with all the magazine editors back when she was a teenager, Eleanor explained.
Why on earth would she do that?
Don't you know my husband's family by now? They would rather die than appear in print, Eleanor said.
What? Have they become too grand to be seen mingling with other Singaporeans?
Nadine said indignantly.
Ayah, Nadine, there's a difference between being grand and being discreet, Daisy commented, knowing full well that families like the Leongs and the Youngs guarded their privacy to the point of obsession.
Grand or not, I think Astrid is wonderful, Carol chimed in. You know, I'm not supposed to say, but Astrid wrote the biggest check at the fundraiser, and she insisted that I keep it anonymous. But her donation was what made this year's gala a record-breaking success.
Eleanor eyed the pretty new mainland Chinese maid entering the room, wondering if this was another one of the girls that the Dato had handpicked from that employment agency he frequented in Suzhou, the city reputed to have the most beautiful women in China.
What do we have today? She asked Carol as the maid placed a familiar, bulky mother-of-pearl chest beside the bed.
Oh, I wanted to show you what I bought on my Burma trip.
Eleanor flipped open the lid of the chest eagerly and began methodically taking out the stacked black velvet trays. One of her favorite parts of Thursday Bible study was looking at Carol's latest acquisitions. Soon, the bed was lined with trays containing a blinding array of jewels.
What intricate crosses! I didn't realize they did such good setting work in Burma.
No, no, those crosses are Harry Winston, Carol corrected. The rubies are from Burma.
Lorena got up from her lunch and headed straight for the bed, holding up one of the lychee-sized rubies to the light.
Ayah, you have to be careful in Burma because so many of their rubies are synthetically treated to boost the redness.
Being the wife of Lawrence Lim, of the Lorient Jewelry Limbs, Lorena could speak on this topic with authority.
I thought rubies from Burma were supposed to be the best, Eleanor remarked. Ladies, you need to stop calling it Burma. It's been called Myanmar for more than 20 years now, Daisy corrected. Alamak, you sound just like Nikki, always correcting me, Eleanor said. Hey, speaking of Nick, when does he arrive from New York? Isn't he the best man at Colin Koo's wedding? Daisy asked. Yes, yes, but you know my son. I'm always the last to know anything, Eleanor complained. Isn't he staying with you? Of course, he always stays with us first, before heading to old ladies, Eleanor said, using her nickname for her mother-in-law.
Well, Daisy continued, lowering her voice a bit, what do you think old lady will do about his guest?
What do you mean? What guest?
Eleanor asked. The one he's bringing to the wedding, Daisy replied slowly, her eyes darting around at the other ladies mischievously, knowing they all knew to whom she was referring.
What are you talking about?
Who is he bringing? Eleanor said, a little confused.
His latest girlfriend, La, Lorena revealed.
No such thing. No way Nikki has a girlfriend, Eleanor insisted.
Why is it so hard for you to believe your son has a girlfriend? Lorena asked.
She had always found Nick to be the most dashing young man of his generation. And with all that young money, it was such a pity her good-for-nothing daughter Tiffany never managed to attract him.
But surely you've heard about this girl? The one from New York, Daisy said in a whisper, relishing that she was the one breaking the news to Eleanor.
An American girl? Nikki wouldn't dare do such a thing. Daisy, your information is always top parquet.
What do you mean? My news is not top parquet. It's very accurate and comes from the most reliable source.
Anyway, I hear she's Chinese, Daisy offered.
Really? What's her name and where's she from? Daisy, if you tell me she's from mainland China, I think I'll have a stroke, Eleanor warned.
I heard she's from Taiwan, Daisy said carefully.
Oh, my goodness. I hope she's not one of those Taiwanese tornadoes, Nadine cackled.
What do you mean by that? Eleanor asked.
You know how notorious those Taiwanese girls can be. They swoop in unexpectedly. The men fall head over heels, and before you know it, they are gone. But not before sucking up every last dollar, just like a tornado, Nadine explained. I know so many men who have fallen prey. Think about Mrs. Casey Tang's son, Gerald, whose wife cleaned him out and ran off with all the Tang heirlooms. Or poor Annie Sim, who lost her husband to that lounge singer from Taipei.
At this moment, Carol's husband entered the room.
Hello, hello, ladies. How is Jesus time today? He said, puffing away on his cigar and swirling his goblet of Hennessy, looking every portly inch the caricature of an Asian tycoon.
Hello, Tato, the ladies said in unison, hurriedly shifting themselves into more decorous positions.
Tato, Daisy here is trying to give me a stroke. She's telling everyone that Nikki has a new Taiwanese girlfriend, Eleanor cried.
Relax, Lily. Taiwanese girls are lovely. They really know how to take care of a man, and maybe she'll be prettier than all those spoiled, inbred girls you try to matchmake him to. The Dato grinned.
Anyway, he continued, suddenly lowering his voice, if I were you, I would be less worried about young Nicholas and more worried about Sinaland right now.
Why? What's happening to Sinaland? Eleanor asked.
Sinaland, Totue. It's going to collapse,
the Dato declared with a satisfied grin.
But Sinaland is blue chip. How can that be? My brother even told me they have all these new projects in Western China, Lorena argued. The Chinese government, my source assures me, has pulled out of that huge new development in Xinjiang. I just unloaded my shares, and I'm shorting 100,000 shares every hour until market closes.
With that, the Dato expelled a big puff of smoke from his cohiba and pressed a button next to the bed. The vast wall of glass facing the sparkling swimming pool began to tilt 45 degrees like an enormous cantilevered garage door, and the Dato lumbered out into the garden toward the main house. For a few seconds, the room went absolutely still. You could almost hear the wheels in each woman's head whirling into overdrive. Daisy suddenly jumped up from her chair, spilling the tray of noodles onto the floor.
Quick, quick! Where's my handbag? I need to call my broker!
Eleanor and Lorena both scrambled for their cell phones as well. Nadine had her stockbroker on speed dial and was already screaming into her phone.
Dump all of it! Sinaland! Yes, dump it all. I just heard from the horse's mouth that it's gone case.
Lorena was on the other end of the bed, cupping her phone close to her mouth.
Desmond, I don't care. Please, just start shorting it now.
Daisy began to hyperventilate.
Some Tonga, I'm losing millions by the second. Where is my bloody broker? Don't tell me that moron is still at lunch.
Carol calmly reached for the touchscreen panel by her bedside table.
May May, can you please come in and clean up a spill?
Then she closed her eyes, lifted her arms into the air, and began to pray aloud.
Oh, Jesus, our personal Lord and Savior, blessed be your name. We come to you humbly asking for your forgiveness today, as we have all sinned against you. Thank you for showering your blessings upon us. Thank you, Lord Jesus, for the fellowship that we share today, for the nourishing food we enjoyed, for the power of your holy word. Please watch over dear Sister Eleanor, Sister Lorena, Sister Daisy, and Sister Nadine as they try to sell their Sinaland shares.
Carol opened her eyes for a moment, noting with satisfaction that Eleanor, at least, was praying along with her. But of course, she couldn't know that behind those serene eyelids, Eleanor was praying for something else entirely.
A Taiwanese girl. Please, God, let it not be true.
Chapter 3. Rachel Chu, New York. It would be just after dinner time in Cupertino, and on the nights she wasn't at Nick's, it became Rachel's habit to call her mother right as she was getting into bed.
Guess who just closed the deal on the big house on Laurel Glen Drive?
Carrie Chu boasted excitedly in Mandarin as soon as she picked up the phone.
Wow, Mom, congratulations. Isn't that your third sale this month?
Rachel asked.
Yes, I broke last year's office record. You see, I knew I made the right decision to join Mimi Shen at the Los Altos office,
Carrie said with satisfaction.
You're going to make Realtor of the Year again, I just know it,
Rachel replied, refluffing the pillow under her head. Well, I have some exciting news, too. Nick invited me to come with him to Asia this summer.
He did?
Carrie remarked, her voice lowering an octave. Mom, don't start getting any ideas, Rachel warned, knowing that tone of her mother's so well.
Hiya! What ideas? When you brought Nick home last Thanksgiving, everyone who saw you two lovebird together say you were perfect for each other. Now, it's his turn to introduce you to his family. Do you think he's going to propose?
Carrie gushed, unable to contain herself. Mom, we've never once talked about marriage, Rachel said, trying to downplay it.
As excited as she was about all the possibilities that hung over the trip, she wasn't going to encourage her mom for the time being.
Her mother was already far too invested in her happiness, and she didn't want to get her hopes up too much. Still, Carrie was brimming with anticipation.
Daughter, I know men like Nick. He can act the bohemian scholar all he wants, but I know deep down he is the marrying kind. He wants to settle down and have many children, so there is no more time to waste.
Mom, just stop. Besides, how many nights a week do you already spend at his place? I'm shocked you two haven't moved in together yet.
You're the only Chinese mom I know who's actually encouraging her daughter to shack up with a guy, Rachel laughed.
I'm the only Chinese mother with an unmarried daughter who's almost 30. Do you know all the inquiries I get almost every day?
I'm getting tired of defending you.
Why, even yesterday, I ran into Ming Chung at Pete's Coffee.
I know you wanted your daughter to get her career established first, but isn't it time that girl got married? She asked.
You know, her daughter Jessica is engaged to the number 7 guy at Facebook, right?
Yeah. I know the whole story.
Instead of an engagement ring, he endowed a scholarship in her name at Stanford, Rachel said in a bored tone.
And she's nowhere as pretty as you, Carrie said indignantly.
All your uncles and aunties gave up on you a long time ago, but I always knew you were waiting for the right one.
Of course, you had to choose a professor just like yourself. At least your children will get a discount on tuition. That's the only way the two of you can afford to put them through college.
Speaking of uncles and aunties, promise me you won't go telling everyone right away.
Please, Rachel pleaded.
Yeah, okay, okay. I know you are always so cautious and you don't want to be disappointed. But I just know in my heart what's going to happen, her mother said merrily.
Well, until something happens, there's no point making a big deal out of it, Rachel insisted.
So, where will you be staying in Singapore?
At his parents' place, I guess.
Do they live in a house or an apartment? Carrie asked.
I have no idea.
You must find out these things.
Why does it matter? Are you going to try to sell them a house in Singapore?
I tell you why it matters. Do you know what the sleeping arrangements will be?
Sleeping arrangements? What are you talking about, Mom?
Hiya, do you know if you will be in a guest bedroom or sharing a bed with him?
It never occurred to me.
Daughter, this is the most important thing. You mustn't assume that Nick's parents are going to be as liberal-minded as I am. You are going to Singapore, and those Chinese Singaporeans are the most uptight of all the Chinese, you know? I don't want his parents to think I didn't raise you properly.
Rachel sighed. She knew her mother meant well, but as usual, she had managed to stress her out about details Rachel never would have imagined.
Now, we must plan what you will bring as a present for Nick's parents,
Carrie continued eagerly.
Find out what Nick's father likes to drink. Scotch, vodka, whiskey. I have so many spare bottles of Johnnie Walker Red left over from the office Christmas party, I can send you one.
Mom, I'm not going to cart over a bottle of booze that they can get there. Let me think of the perfect present to bring them from America.
I know just the thing for Nick's mother. You should go to Macy's and buy her one of those pretty gold powder compacts from Estee Lauder. They are having a special offer right now, and it comes with a free gift, an expensive-looking leather pouch with lipstick and perfume and eye cream samples. Trust me, every Asian woman loves those free gifts.
Don't worry, Mom. I'll take care of it. Chapter 4 Nicholas Young, New York. Nick was slouched on his battered leather sofa grading term papers when Rachel casually brought it up.
So, what's the story when we're staying at your parents' place? Are we sharing a bedroom or would they be scandalized?
Nick cocked his head.
I suppose we'll be in the same room.
You suppose or you know?
Don't worry. Once we arrive, everything will get sorted.
Get sorted. Normally, Rachel found Nick's British-y phrases so charming, but in this instance, it was a tad frustrating. Sensing her unease, Nick got up, walked over to where she was sitting, and kissed the top of her head tenderly.
Relax. My parents aren't the kind of people who pay any attention to sleeping arrangements.
Rachel wondered if that was really true. She tried to go back to reading the State Department's Southeast Asia Travel Advisory website. As she sat there in the glow of the laptop, Nick couldn't help but marvel at how beautiful his girlfriend looked, even at the end of a long day. How did he get so lucky? Everything about her, from the dewy just back from a morning run on the beach complexion, to the obsidian black hair that stopped just short of her collarbone, conveyed a natural, uncomplicated beauty so different from the red carpet-ready girls he had grown up around. Now Rachel was absent-mindedly rubbing her index finger back and forth over her upper lip, her brow slightly furrowed. Nick knew that gesture well. What was she worrying about? Ever since he had invited Rachel to Asia a few days ago, the questions had been piling on steadily. Where were they staying? What gift should she bring for his parents? What had Nick told them about her? Nick wished he could stop that brilliant analytical mind of hers from overthinking every aspect of the trip. He was beginning to see that Astrid had been right. Astrid was not only his cousin, she was his closest female confidant, and he had first fielded the idea of inviting Rachel to Singapore during their phone conversation a week ago.
First of all, you know you'll be instantly escalating things to the next level, don't you? Is that what you really want?
Astrid asked point blank.
No, well, maybe. This is just a summer holiday.
Come on, Nikki, this is not just a summer holiday. That's not how women think, and you know it. You've been dating seriously for almost 2 years now. You're 32, and up till now, you have never brought anyone home. This is major. Everyone is going to assume that you're going to.
Please, Nick warned.
Don't say the M word. See? You know, that is precisely what will be on everyone's mind. Most of all, I can guarantee you it's on Rachel's mind. Nick sighed. Why did everything have to be so fraught with significance? This always happened whenever he sought the female perspective. Maybe calling Astrid was a bad idea. She was older than him by just 6 months, but sometimes she slipped into big sister mode too much. He preferred the capricious, devil-may-care side of Astrid.
I just want to show Rachel my part of the world, that's all. No strings attached, he tried to explain. And I guess part of me wants to see how she'll react to it.
By it, you mean our family, Astrid said.
No, not just our family, my friends, the island, everything.
Can't I go on holiday with my girlfriend without it becoming a diplomatic incident? Astrid paused for a moment, trying to assess the situation. This was the most serious her cousin had ever gotten with anyone. Even if he wasn't ready to admit it to himself, she knew that on a subconscious level, at least, he was taking the next crucial step on the way to the altar. But that step needed to be handled with extreme care. Was Nicky truly prepared for all the landmines he would be setting off? He could be rather oblivious to the intricacies of the world he had been born into. Maybe he had always been shielded by their grandmother since he was the apple of her eye. Or maybe Nick had just spent too many years living outside of Asia. In their world, you did not bring home some unknown girl unannounced.
You know I think Rachel is lovely, I really do. But if you invite her to come home with you, it will change things between you, whether you like it or not. Now, I'm not concerned about whether your relationship can handle it. I know it can. My worry is more about how everyone else is going to react. You know how small the island is. You know how things can get with.
Astrid's voice was suddenly drowned out by the staccato scream of a police siren.
That was a strange noise. Where are you right now? Nick asked.
I'm on the street, Astrid replied.
In Singapore?
No, in Paris.
What? Paris? Nick was confused.
Yep. I'm en Rue de Berry, and two police cars just whizzed by.
I thought you were in Singapore. Sorry for calling so late. I thought it was morning for you.
No, it's fine. It's only 1:30. I'm just walking back to the hotel.
Is Michael with you?
No, he's in China for work.
What are you up to in Paris?
Just my annual spring trip, you know.
Oh, right.
Nick remembered that Astrid spent every April in Paris for her couture fittings. He had met her in Paris once before, and he could still recall the fascination and tedium he felt sitting in the Yves Saint Laurent atelier on Avenue Marceau, watching three seamstresses buzz around Astrid as she stood, zen-like, swathed in an airy confection for what seemed like 10 hours, guzzling down Diet Cokes to fight off her jet lag. She looked to him like a figure from a Baroque painting, a Spanish infanta submitting to an archaic costuming ritual straight out of the 17th century.
It was a particularly uninspired season, Astrid had told him, and she was buying only 12 pieces that spring, spending well over €1 million.
Nick didn't even want to imagine how much money she must be blowing on this trip, with no one there to rein her in.
I miss Paris. It's been ages since I've been.
Remember our crazy trip there with Eddie? He said.
Ayo, please, don't remind me. That's the last time I ever share a suite with that rascal.
Astrid shuddered, thinking she would never be able to erase the image of her Hong Kong cousin with that amputee stripper and those profiteroles.
Are you staying in the penthouse at the George V?
As always.
You're such a creature of habit. It would be super easy to assassinate you.
Why don't you try?
Well, next time you're in Paris, let me know. I might just surprise you and hop the pond with my special assassin's kit.
Are you going to knock me out, put me in a bathtub, and pour acid all over me?
No. For you, there will be a far more elegant solution. Well, come and get me. I'll be here till early May.
Don't you get some sort of spring break soon? Why not bring Rachel to Paris for a long weekend?
Wish I could. Spring break was last month, and we interim adjunct sub-associate professors don't get any extra vacation days. But Rachel and I have the whole summer off, which is why I want her to come home with me.
Astrid sighed.
You know what will happen the minute you land at Changi Airport with this girl on your arm, don't you? You know how brutal it was for Michael when we first started going out publicly. That was 5 years ago, and he's still getting used to it. Do you really think Rachel's ready for all that? Are you ready for it?
Nick remained silent. He was taking in everything Astrid had to say, but his mind was already made up. He was ready. He was absolutely head over heels in love with Rachel, and it was time to show her off to the whole world.
Nikki, how much does she know? Astrid asked.
About what?
About our family.
Not much. You're the only one she's met. She thinks you've got great taste in shoes and that your husband spoils you rotten. That's about it.
You probably want to prepare her a bit, Astrid said with a laugh.
What is there to prepare her for? Nick asked breezily. Listen, Nikki, Astrid said, her tone getting serious. You can't just throw Rachel into the deep end like this. You need to prep her. Do you hear me?
Chapter 5. Astrid Leung, Paris. Every May 1st, the Lermet Pierres, one of France's great banking families, would host Le Bal de Muguet, a sumptuous ball that was the highlight of the spring social season. This year, as Astrid entered the arched passageway leading into the Lermet Pierres' splendid Hôtel Particulier on Île Saint-Louis, she was handed a delicate sprig of flowers by a footman in smart black and gold livery.
It's after Charles IX, you know. He would present lilies of the valley to all the ladies at Fontainebleau every May Day, a woman wearing a tiara explained to her as they emerged into the courtyard where hundreds of miniature 18th-century hot air balloons floated among the topiaries. Astrid barely had time to take in the delightful sight when the Vicomtesse Nathalie de Lermet-Pierre pounced on her.
I'm so glad you could make it,
Nathalie effused, greeting Astrid with quadruple cheek kisses.
My goodness, is that linen?
Only you could get away with wearing a simple linen dress to a ball, Astrid.
The hostess laughed, admiring the delicate Grecian folds of Astrid's buttercup yellow gown.
Wait a minute. Is this an original, Madame Grey?
Nathalie asked, realizing that she had seen a similar dress at the Musée Galliera.
From her early period, Astrid replied, almost embarrassed to have been found out.
But of course! My goodness, Astrid! You've outdone yourself once again. How on earth did you get your hands on an early Grey?
Nathalie asked in awe.
Recovering herself, she whispered,
I hope you don't mind, but I have put you next to Grégoire. He is being a beast tonight as he thinks I am still fucking the Croatian. You are the only person I can trust next to him at dinner. But at least you'll have Louis on your left.
Don't worry about me. I always enjoy catching up with your husband, and it will be a treat to sit next to Louis.
I just saw his new film the other day. Wasn't it a pretentious bore? Hated the black and white, but at least Louis looked edible with his clothes off. Anyway, thank you for being my savior. Are you sure you have to leave tomorrow?
The hostess asked with a pout. I've been gone almost a month. I'm afraid my son will forget who I am if I stay one more day. Astrid answered as she was ushered along into the grand foyer, where Nathalie's mother-in-law, the Comtesse Isabelle de Lermet-Pierre, presided over the receiving line. Isabelle let out a small gasp when she caught sight of Astrid.
Astrid, quelle surprise!
Well, I wasn't sure that I would be able to attend until the last minute, Astrid said apologetically, smiling at the stiff-looking grande dame standing beside Comtesse Isabelle.
The woman did not smile back. Rather, she tilted her head ever so slightly as if appraising every inch of Astrid, the gigantic emerald earrings fastened to her long earlobes swaying precariously.
Astrid Leung, permit me to present my dear friend, Baronne Marie-Hélène de la Durée.
The Baronne nodded curtly, before turning back to the Comtesse and resuming their conversation. As soon as Astrid had moved on, Marie-Hélène said to Isabelle, sotto voce,
Did you notice that necklace she was wearing? I saw it at Jar last week. It's unbelievable what these girls can get their hands on nowadays. Tell me, Isabelle, whom does she belong to? Marie-Hélène, Astrid is not a kept woman. We've not a family for years.
Oh,
who is her family? Marie-Hélène asked in astonishment. The Leongs are a Chinese family from Singapore.
Ah, yes. I've heard that the Chinese are getting quite rich these days. In fact, I read that there are now more millionaires in Asia than in all of Europe. Who would have ever imagined?
No, no. I'm afraid you don't quite understand. Astrid's people have been wealthy for generations. Her father is one of Laurent's biggest clients, Isabel whispered.
My dear, are you giving away all my secrets again?
Comte Laurent de la Mère Pierre remarked as he rejoined his wife in the receiving line.
Not at all. Merely enlightening Marie-Hélène about the Leongs,
Isabel replied, flicking away a speck of lint on her husband's grosgrain lapel.
Ah, the Leongs.
Why? Is the ravishing Astrid here tonight?
You just missed her. But don't worry.
You have all night to ogle her across the dinner table. Isabel teased, explaining to Marie-Hélène. Both my husband and my son have been obsessed with Astrid for years.
Well, why not? A girl like Astrid only exists to feed obsession,
Laurent remarked. Isabel smacked her husband's arm in mock outrage.
Laurent, tell me, how is it possible that these Chinese have been rich for generations?
Marie-Hélène inquired.
I thought they were all penniless communists in drab little Mao uniforms not too long ago.
Well, first of all, you must understand that there are two kinds of Chinese. There are the Chinese from mainland China who made their fortunes in the past decade, like all the Russians. But then there are the overseas Chinese. These are the ones who left China long before the communists came in many cases hundreds of years ago, and spread throughout the rest of Asia, quietly amassing great fortunes over time. If you look at all the countries in Southeast Asia, especially Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, you'll see that virtually all the commerce is controlled by the overseas Chinese, like the Liems in Indonesia, the Tans in the Philippines, the Leongs in... His wife cut in.
Let me just say this. We visited Astrid's family a few years ago. You can't imagine how staggeringly rich these people are, Marie-Hélène. The houses, the servants, the style in which they live, it makes the Arnauds look like peasants. What's more, I've been told that Astrid is a double heiress. There's an even more enormous fortune on her mother's side.
Is that so? Marie-Hélène said in astonishment, staring across the room at the girl with renewed interest.
Well, she is rather soignée, she conceded.
Oh, she's incredibly chic. One of the few from her generation who gets it right, the Comtesse decreed.
François-Marie tells me Astrid has a couture collection that rivals the Shaker of Qatar's. She never attends the shows because she loathes to be photographed, but she goes straight to the ateliers and snaps up dozens of dresses every season as if they were mackerel.
Astrid was in the salon admiring the Balthus portrait over the mantelpiece when someone behind her said, "That's Laurent's mother, you know." It was the Baronne Marie-Hélène de la Durée, this time attempting a smile on her tightly pulled face.
"I thought it might be," Astrid replied. "Chérie, I must tell you how much I adore your necklace. In fact, I had admired it at Monsieur Rosenthal's a few weeks ago, but sadly he informed me it was already spoken for." The Baron gushed. "I can see now that you were clearly meant to wear it."
"Thank you, but you've got the most magnificent earrings," Astrid replied sweetly, rather amused by the woman's sudden about-face.
"Isabel tells me that you are from Singapore. I've heard so much about your country, about how it's become the Switzerland of Asia. My granddaughter is making a trip to Asia this summer. Perhaps you will be kind enough to give her some advice?"
"Of course," Astrid said politely, thinking to herself. Wow, it only took 5 minutes for this lady to go from snooty to suck-up. It was quite disappointing, really. Paris was her escape, and here she strove to be invisible, to be just another of the countless Asian tourists who crammed eagerly into the boutiques along the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. It was this luxury of anonymity that made her love the City of Lights.
but living here several years back had changed all of that. Her parents, concerned that she was living alone in a foreign city with no proper chaperone, made the mistake of alerting friends in Paris, like the Lermet Pierres. Word had gotten out, and suddenly she was no longer just the jeune fille renting a loft in the Marais. She was Harry Leung's daughter, or Shang Suyi's granddaughter. It was so frustrating. Of course, she should be used to this by now, to people talking about her as soon as she left the room. It had been going on practically since the day she was born. To understand why, one had to first consider the obvious, her astonishing beauty. Astrid wasn't attractive in the typical almond-eyed Hong Kong starlet sort of way, nor was she the flawless celestial maiden type. One could say that Astrid's eyes were set too far apart, and her jawline, so similar to the men on her mother's side, was too prominent for a girl. Yet somehow with her delicate nose, bee-stung lips, and long, naturally wavy hair, it all came together to form an inexplicably alluring vision. She was always that girl, stopped on the street by modeling scouts, though her mother fended them off brusquely. Astrid was not going to be modeling for anyone, and certainly not for money. Such things were far beneath her. And that was the other, more essential detail about Astrid. She was born into the uppermost echelon of Asian wealth, a secretive, rarefied circle of families, virtually unknown to outsiders who possessed immeasurably vast fortunes. For starters, her father hailed from the Penang Liangs, a venerable Straits Chinese family that held a monopoly over the palm oil industry. The Straits Chinese, also known as Peranakans, are the descendants of 16th-century Chinese immigrants to the Malaya region. Often intermarried with the native Malays, they created a unique culture that is a hybrid of Chinese, Malay, English, Dutch, and Indian influences. They were the elites of Singapore, English-educated and more loyal to the British than to China. But adding even more oomph to Astrid's bloodlines, her mother was the eldest daughter of Sir James Young and the even more imperial Shang Suyi. Astrid's Aunt Catherine had married a minor Thai prince. Another was married to the renowned Hong Kong cardiologist Malcolm Cheng. One could go on for hours diagramming all the dynastic links in Astrid's family tree, but from any angle you looked at it, Astrid's pedigree was nothing short of extraordinary. And as Astrid took her place at the candlelit banquet table in the Lermet Pierre's long gallery, surrounded by the gleaming Louis XV Sèvres and Rose Period Picassos, she could not have suspected just how extraordinary life was about to become. Chapter 6. The Chengs, Hong Kong. Most people driving past the squat, grayish-brown building on a busy intersection of Causeway Bay would likely assume it was some sort of government health office, but the Chinese Athletic Association was actually one of Hong Kong's most exclusive private clubs. Despite its rather perfunctory name, it was the first Chinese-founded sports facility in the former British Crown Colony. It boasted the legendary gambling tycoon Stanley Low as its honorary president, and its restrictive membership had an 8-year waiting list open only to the most established families. The CAA's public rooms were still firmly entrenched in late 70s chrome and leather decor, since members voted to spend all the money on updating the sports facilities. Only the acclaimed restaurant had been revamped in the last few years into a plush dining room with pale rose brocade walls and windows overlooking the main tennis courts. The round tables were strategically aligned so that everyone was seated with a view of the restaurant's main door, allowing its esteemed members to make a grand entrance in their après-sport outfits and making mealtimes a prime spectator sport. Every Sunday afternoon, the Cheng family would come together without fail for lunch at the CAA. No matter how busy or hectic the week had been, everyone knew that Sunday dim sum at the clubhouse, as they called it, was mandatory attendance by all family members who were in town. Dr. Malcolm Cheng was Asia's most esteemed heart surgeon. So prized were his skilled hands that he was famous for always wearing lambskin gloves, made specially for him by Dunhill, to protect his precious hands whenever he ventured out in public, and he took additional measures to safeguard them from the wear and tear of driving, opting instead to be chauffeured in his Rolls-Royce Silver Spirit. This was something his well-brought-up wife, the former Alexandra Alex Young of Singapore, felt to be overly ostentatious, so she preferred to call for a taxi wherever possible and allow her husband the exclusive use of his car and driver. After all, she was keen to say, he's saving people's lives every day, and I'm just a housewife. This self-deprecation was standard behavior for Alexandra, even though she was the true architect of their fortune. As a bored doctor's wife, Alexandra began channeling every cent of her husband's considerable earnings into properties, just as the Hong Kong housing boom was taking off. She found that she had a preternatural talent for timing the market, so beginning in the oil recession days of the 70s, through the communist panic sell-off of the mid-80s and the Asian financial crisis of 1997, Alexandra was always snapping up properties when they hit rock bottom and selling at the peak. By the middle of the first decade of the new century, with Hong Kong property going for more money per square foot than anywhere else in the world, the Changs found themselves sitting on one of the largest privately held real estate portfolios on the island. Sunday lunch gave Malcolm and his wife a chance to inspect their children and grandchildren on a weekly basis, and it was a duty they undertook with utter seriousness. For in spite of all the advantages the Chang children had growing up, Malcolm and Alexandra were constantly worrying about them. Actually, Alexandra was the one doing most of the worrying. Their youngest son, Alistair, the hopeless one, was the pampered ne'er-do-well who had just barely scraped through Sydney University and was now doing something or other in the Hong Kong film industry. He had recently become involved with Kitty Pong, a soap opera star who claimed she was from a good Taiwanese family, even though everyone else in the Chang family doubted it, since her spoken Mandarin took on a distinctive Northern China accent rather than the more cutesy inflections of Taiwanese Mandarin. Their daughter, Cecilia, the horsey one, had developed a passion for dressage at an early age and was constantly dealing with her temperamental horse or her temperamental husband, Tony, an Australian commodities trader whom Malcolm and Alexandra secretly nicknamed the Convict. A full-time mother, Cecilia actually spent more time on the international equestrian circuit than raising their son, Jake. Due to all the hours he spent with their Filipino maids, Jake was becoming fluent in Tagalog. He could also do a brilliant impression of Sinatra's My Way.